Let's see. So today we're going to continue talking about quantum error correction. And then after today, we only have one more lecture. So there's no lecture tomorrow. And then the last lecture will be on Friday, and we'll talk about quantum key distribution. So today we're going to try to finish up talking about quantum error correction. And then I'll talk about stabilizer codes, which is a nice framework in which you can talk about many, but not all, quantum error correcting codes. And then we'll talk a little bit about fault tolerance, which is the idea of how you would do quantum computing even in the presence of noise. So not just storing information, but actually computing on encoded information. So it stays, you can do things reliably even in the presence of noise. And that's, there are a lot of details there that we won't be able to talk about, but at least I'll give you some of the flavor of, what we can say about fault tolerance. So last time we started talking about error correcting codes. We talked mainly about classical error correcting codes. And we looked at the example of this, this 3-bit repetition code that would allow you to correct against any bit flip on a, any single bit flip that would occur on your encoded qubits. Any bit flip occurring on one of the 3 physical qubits would cause an error that could be detected and then corrected. And then we talked about how you could make that into a quantum code that would correct against any single qubit X error, and it would work even on superpositions. The way that it worked was that we would encode our quantum data into, some logical basis states, which are 000 and 111. And this is the circuit that does that encoding. And then there's some way of extracting some information about what error had occurred. That information is called the syndrome. And so that, this piece of this quantum circuit we'll compute the syndrome. We compute the parities of bits 1 and 2 here and of bits 2 and 3 here. And then once you know what the syndrome is, then you can perform a correction. So we saw that, for example, if you had a 0, 1, that meant that there was a, for the syndrome, that meant that there was a, under the assumption that there was either a 0 or 1 bit flip on these qubits, then the error must have occurred here on the third bit. So when I draw this quantum circuit like this, this is a control, and this is a control on 0. So this means that this NOT gate will be applied only when these 2 bits are in the state 0, 1. Right? So we can write this error correction like this. So we didn't write it like this before, but we described what the correction would be on the basis of the syndrome. So this is a code that would correct against any single qubit X error. And now what we would like to do is understand error correcting codes for the more general situation where we could have arbitrary errors. And we discussed last time the error model for quantum error correction, where we would think about, the most general thing that could happen would be we could have any completely positive map, any completely positive trace preserving map applied to our quantum data. But we could always think about that as some unitary interaction with an environment. And you could decompose that interaction in terms of a linear combination of terms where we apply some Pauli error to our logical, to our physical qubits. So we either do the identity, or we do X, or we do Z, or we do Y. Or we could think about that as doing, both a Z and an X error instead. So if we can only correct against single qubit Pauli errors, then in some sense we can correct against any single qubit error. And so this is what we're actually going to try to do, is just to come up with a code that will correct against single qubit Pauli errors. Okay, so the first thing to do, the kind of, very easiest thing to do, is to try to figure out how to correct for, instead of single qubit X errors, single qubit Z errors, right? So there's an easy way of doing this, and this will give us what we would call the 3-qubit phase flip code. So again, there's a code which will encode a single logical qubit into 3 physical qubits, and it will be able to protect against any single qubit Pauli Z error. And the way that that works is quite straightforward. I mean, here we have something that will encode, that will be able to correct against bit flips, because what it does is it encodes a 0 into 3 zeros and a 1 into 3 ones. And if we just go into the Hadamard transform basis, so, we have HXH is Z, right? So we have here a code that will correct against single qubit X errors. And so if we just Hadamard transform everything, we just go into the Hadamard transform basis, then what we're going to get is a code that will protect against Z errors. So, the idea is just as follows. Our logical zero state is going to be the state plus plus plus, because we just take the state we have before and we Hadamard transform it. Our logical one state is going to be the state minus minus minus. So these are 2 orthogonal states, but they've encoded the quantum information in some redundant way so that we have some protection against, well, now we have no protection against bit flip errors, but we have some protection against phase flip errors. And now, you know, you could do exactly the same thing, and we're just kind of, you know, you would just have to appropriately Hadamard transform everything. So for example, if we wanted to extract the syndrome, what would the syndrome be? Well, we would again just compute these parities, but we would compute them in the Hadamard transform basis. So the syndrome would be the, you know, the parity of qubits 1 and 2, and separately of qubits 2 and 3 in the plus minus basis. So, you know, you would ask, are qubits 1 and 2 either both in the state plus or both in the state minus? Or are we in the situation where one is in the state plus and the other is in the state minus? Right? And you could always, you know, decompose things in that basis, and there's going to be some subspace in which you have, you know, even parity, and some subspace in which you have odd parity, and that's something that you can measure. And you can easily come up with a circuit that will do this just by, you know, putting in Hadamard gates in the appropriate places. Okay? So this will give us a code that will correct against phase flip errors, against any single qubit Z error. So this will correct for any one Z error. All right. But that's not saying very much. I mean, now this will allow us to correct against one kind of errors, but not the others. So what we would like to do is we would like to get a code that would actually correct for any single qubit error, right? So if we could correct for any X error and any Z error and any XZ error on any one of the qubits, then we would say that we have an error correcting code that could correct for any one, you know, any single qubit error. And now the error that is applied to one qubit might not be literally an X or Z or an X times Z. It could be something in between. It could be, you know, a completely arbitrary thing. But as long as it's a single qubit error, you can always decompose it into those single qubit poly errors. So that's what we would like to be able to do. And there's kind of a straightforward way of doing this, which was, I guess, I think this was the first, you know, code that was proposed that would protect against an arbitrary single qubit error. And you can get it just by combining, just by concatenating these bit flip and phase flip codes. So this code was actually discovered by Peter Shor, the same person who found the factoring algorithm. And the idea is just this, that you combine these two codes. Okay, so here's how this would work. So to correct any one qubit error, combine the bit and phase flip codes. And so now what we're going to be doing is we're going to be encoding one logical qubit into 9 physical qubits, because we're first going to encode with respect to one of these codes, and then we'll encode each of the qubits from that code using the other code. So you could do this in either order, but I guess the way that this is normally done is that, let's say, that the inner code is the phase flip code. So first we encode a 0 as 3 pluses. And then we encode a 1 as 3 minus, and we encode a 1 as 3 minuses. So that's the first thing we do. That's the inner code. And then we take the physical qubits of this encoding, and we encode them using the bit flip code. So we take a 0 at the level of the physical qubits that we have after we do this, and we encode that as 3 zeros. And we take a 1, and we encode that as 3 ones. Right. So in other words, what are the logical states going to look like? So the logical 0 is the state that we get by taking plus, 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 and replacing a 0 by 0, 0, 0, and a 1 by 1, 1, 1. So here we're going to have a 1 over root 8. And then for this plus, we replace that by 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Right? So 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, right? And then we just do exactly the same thing for all three, you know, qubits of this inner code. So 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. Okay, so that's the logical 0 state. It's a 9-qubit state that's somehow redundantly encoded this information. And then our logical one is just going to be the analogous thing where we have the minus combination of 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. Right? So because we have the minus state, and then we encode that using this encoding. So here we're going to have 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 1. So this is now, it turns out, a quantum error-correcting code that can correct a single qubit error that's applied to any one of the logical qubits, right? So, you know, within each block of three, what we have is the bit flip code. So if any single qubit bit flip error has occurred, then within a given block, we can fix that, right? So we can figure out where the bit flip was applied, and then we can go and correct it. And if we have a single qubit Z error, then, you know, what we can do is we can compute the sort of phase parities, right? So the parity of the of whether we have you know, two pluses or two minuses, or whether we have a plus and a minus, or a minus and a plus between two blocks, and from that we can figure out whether a phase flip has been applied. Now there's something kind of interesting to see about what happens if you apply a phase flip, right? If you apply a phase flip, if you apply a Z error on one of the qubits, can you tell, you know, which particular qubit it was applied to? So maybe you can see that you can't in general, right? Because suppose I apply a Z error on the first qubit, right? That's going to change this plus sign into a minus sign, because for the term where I have a 1, I get a minus sign. But if I apply a Z error to the second qubit, it's going to do exactly the same thing, right? So those are two errors that you cannot tell apart. They would have exactly the same syndrome, you know, fortunately, the correction you have to do to fix those errors is exactly the same. So you don't need to know exactly on which qubit the Z error was applied. You just have to know that it was applied to one of these three. And if you apply a Z to, you know, any one of those three, it's going to have the same effect. And so you'll be able to correct things. So that's sort of something that can happen in quantum codes that can't happen for classical codes. That's what goes by the name of degeneracy. So this 9-qubit code is what's called a degenerate code. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on. So, you know, there are some quantum codes that are and some that are not degenerate. It's not something that always happens, but it's something that happens here. Okay, so in any event, by computing some appropriate, you know, so there's some circuit like this that you could come up with that would combine the circuits for the 3-qubit bit flip code and the 3-qubit phase flip code, which is something you get from this by applying some Hadamard transforms. And then you could work out how you would do the syndrome extraction and how you would do the correction, and that would give you some way of correcting for any single qubit error that might be applied to this code. And so the other thing to see, I guess, is that, you know, I've argued that you can correct for any bit flip and for any phase flip error. You also need to be able to correct for both of those things happening, but this code effectively treats those two kinds of errors independently, right? So if you have an X error and a Z error, and you just do the correction of you know, an X error if an X error occurred, and a Z error if a Z error occurred, those things really, you know, really, those two corrections, you know, can be applied just separately, and that will correct the overall combination of the errors. That's also not something that always happens in quantum error correcting codes. It's possible to have a code that will correct an X error, it will correct a Z error, but it won't necessarily correct the combination of the two. But in this case, it turns out to work out. Okay. Questions so far? Yes.
So this should correct any single qubit unitary error? Or
That's right. Because any single qubit unitary error can be expanded in terms of these polygons.
Okay. But this doesn't yet protect us against, like, depolarization or something.
Yes, it does. So if you have a depolarizing error that acts on just one qubit, you can think about that as you know, something that can be expanded in terms of I, X, Y, and Z errors, you know, when you think about the interaction with the environment. And if it's a depolarizing channel that is, you know, say what happens is you pick one of the 9 qubits at random and you apply depolarization to it, that's something you can correct. Now, you know, multi-qubit errors, you can't necessarily correct, but you can correct any single qubit error, even if it's a non-unitary thing. Yeah. And one other thing to observe, by the way, is that there are some multi-qubit errors that can be applied, right? So, for example, if I have a bit flip error on one of these three qubits and then a bit flip error on one of these three qubits, that's something that I can detect because I have separate bit flip codes for this block and for this block. So I actually can correct some multi-qubit errors, but I can't correct arbitrary multi-qubit errors. But that actually might suggest to you, I mean, if you have the ability here to correct some errors that are not just single qubit errors, you might think you could actually do better. Somehow you could improve upon this code. And we'll see something about that later on. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is the short code, the 9-qubit code. Okay, so the next thing that I want to do is I want to tell you about this formalism of what are called stabilizer codes. So this is a formalism for talking about quantum error correcting codes that turns out to be very convenient. So this is a formalism that was developed by Daniel Gottesman, who's now here at PI. And it's a really convenient sort of group theoretic way of talking about quantum codes. It doesn't necessarily describe arbitrary quantum codes, but it actually describes, you know, most of the ones that we care about. So it's a really nice framework. Okay, so what we do in this stabilizer formalism is we describe codes in terms of the operators that we would measure in order to extract the syndrome. Right, so by the operators we measure to determine the syndrome. And in stabilizer codes, these operators that we'll measure to figure out what the syndrome is will always be poly operators. So these operators will be tensor products of poly operators. So they'll come from what's called the poly group. Which are tensor products of poly operators. And if you want to think about this thing as actually a group, if you multiply poly operators together, sometimes you can get some global phase, right? Like if you take x times y, you get I times z. So with overall phase plus or minus 1 or plus or minus I, if you want to make this thing actually a group, although, you know, we can always just write down our stabilizer operators as the ones that have eigenvalues plus 1, as you'll see in a moment, because it won't, this sort of phase information will be something that won't be relevant for the error correcting properties of the code. Okay, so let's think about, you know, at least for the examples that we've seen so far, what are the operators that we would be measuring to figure out what the syndrome is? So this is going to be what's called the stabilizer of the code, and it's going to be a convenient way to describe what's going on. Okay, so for the bit flip code, what are the operators that we would like to measure, right? So the information that we were measuring was the parity of the bits 1 and 2 and the parity of bits 2 and 3. So you could think about that in terms of, you know, what basis we were measuring. Well, we're not making a complete von Neumann measurement in some basis. So, you know, it's more convenient here just to think about what are the operators that we're measuring. So there's some, you know, Hermitian observable that we're measuring in order to figure out the parities of the bits. So what's the observable we want to measure, let's say, if we want to compute the parity of bits 1 and 2? ZZI, exactly, right. So there's ZZI. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write things exactly like you just said it without tensor product symbols, because otherwise it would, you know, I'd be writing a lot of tensor product symbols and, you know, it would take a lot more time. So I'm going to write it exactly like this. And what I mean by this is, you know, Z acting on the first qubit, Z acting on the second qubit, and I acting on the third qubit. I don't mean the product Z times Z times I, which is a single qubit identity operator. I mean, yeah, the tensor product of these operators. So this is the thing that measures the parity of the first two bits, and then the thing that measures the parity of the, gives us the parity of bits 2 and 3 is IZZ. So this is what's called the stabilizer of the code. So if we then consider the phase flip code, Well, this should just give us, you know, what we're measuring should just be the Hadamard transform of what we have in the bitflip code. So here what we want to measure is XXI and IXX. Right? And for the Shor code, this is a little bit trickier. So what are the things that we want to measure for the Shor code? Well, I don't know. Can you tell me one of the stabilizer operators that we want to measure for the Shor code? So these are now going to be, you know, tensor products of 9 poly operators. So for example, something that I want to do is I want to measure, like, you know, the parity of bits 1 and 2, right? Just in the standard basis, because I want to know, are bits 1 and 2, do they have even parity or do they have odd parity, so I can figure out whether there was a bit flip error within the first block of this encoding. Right? So for that, I would just, the operator would just be, you know, z, z, I. There's 7 i's, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Good. Okay, so there would be that operator, and then there would be the one that would operate on bits 2 and 3. Let me not write all the i's, because my hand would start to get tired. But then there would be the operator that would measure zz on bits, in the first 2 bits of the next block, so in other words, on qubits 4 and 5. And then here, zz, and then here, zz, and then here, zz. Okay, so that gives me 6 stabilizer operators. So I want to measure all of those to get the bit flip part of the syndrome. But then there's also some phase flip part of the syndrome, right? So now what I want to do is I want to measure this phase parity between the first block and the second block. So what's the operator that I, or what are the operators that I can measure to get that information? Let me see.
X is on the first 6.
Exactly, yes. Right, so if I have an x on the first 6, okay, somehow I can't line these things up. So if x is on the first 6 and identity is on the last 3, and that's going to tell me what the, you know, what the parity of the phase is between this block and this block. Right, so this XXX is something that's going to have an eigenvalue of plus 1 or minus 1, depending on whether I'm in the plus state or the minus state for these first 3 qubits, but then I want the parity of those 2 things, so I have the product of these 2 XXX operators. And then I have exactly the same thing for the second and third blocks. So that's going to be the identity on the first 3, and X is on the remaining 3. Okay, hopefully you can tell what's going on, even though I can't seem to write straight. Okay, so these are going to be now all of our stabilizer operators. So we're going to have 8 stabilizer operators in this case. We have these 6 that we measure in order to figure out what's going on between for the bit flip code, and we have these 2 operators that we measure to figure out what's going on for the phase flip code. So you know the code treats bit flips and phase flips asymmetrically because you chose one of the codes to be the inner code and the other code to be the outer code. You know, you could make either choice, but this is what we get if we make this particular choice. Okay. All right, so these are some operators which are significant in that if you wanted to figure out what the syndrome was, they're the operators you would measure. So that's one, you know, certainly one thing which is significant about them. But more so than that, it turns out that these operators actually completely specify the code. So they're not just something that they're not just the thing that you would measure. Actually, if you know what these operators are, that tells you what the code words are. It tells you what the code is. So you can think about this syndrome, sorry, about the stabilizer, the set of stabilizer operators, as really a specification of the entire code. So stabilizer specifies the code. One thing to observe, if you look at how these operators act on the code states, is that the states in the code are all plus 1 eigenvectors of these operators. Right? If we look at the bit flip code, if I act with, say, ZZI on either 0, 0, 0 or 1, 1, 1, I'm going to get plus 1. And, you know, similarly for IZZ. And it's the same for all of these. And you could think about acting with any of these stabilizer operators on any code word, on any state that represents a valid encoding of your quantum information. And what you'll find is that it's a plus 1 eigenvector. Right? So the code words are the simultaneous, well, all of the code words are simultaneous plus 1 eigenvectors. Of the stabilizer operators. But it turns out that the simultaneous plus 1 eigenspace of the stabilizer operators is exactly the code space. Okay, so let me give you a definition. So what is the stabilizer of a code? The stabilizer is just going to be the set of all of the you know, the operators that when you act with them on code states, you get plus 1. You get you get the state back, so that those states are plus 1 eigenvectors. Okay, so the stabilizer of a code is S, which is the sum over, which is the set of all poly operators. So this is you know, a code that encodes things into n qubits. So here, this is the n qubit poly group. So these are all of the poly operators on n qubits that have the property that when you act with those operators on any code state psi, you just get the state back. Okay, so this should be the case for all code words psi. Right, so a code word is something which is the valid encoding of some quantity. Okay, so you know, just right here, this is the n qubit poly group. So this thing, the stabilizer of a code, you can show that it's an abelian group, right? I mean, I guess that should be, that should be clear. I mean, if you have some m, and then you have some other m prime that also has this property, and you multiply them together, then you're going to get the, if both m and m prime have this property, then their product will have this property. And you can also show that this group is abelian. So if you take any two operators in the stabilizer and you multiply them together, you get another stabilizer operator. So actually what we're writing down here, when we write the operators that you measure in order to compute the syndrome, we're writing not the entire stabilizer group, but a generating set for the stabilizer group. So you could take, for example, the product of ZZI and IZZ, and you would get something else that's in the stabilizer, according to this definition. Namely, you would get ZIZ. But that's something that you don't have to measure, because if you know what the parity of the first two qubits is, and you know what the parity of the second and third qubits is, then you know also the parity of the first and the third qubit. That's some information that you can derive. So here we're just writing a generating set for the stabilizer, and this is what the entire stabilizer is for a code. Questions? All right. So that's the stabilizer of a code. As I said, the stabilizer is an abelian group. Not only is the stabilizer of any code an abelian group, but you can really think about just specifying, any abelian subgroup of the poly group, and that will always specify some code. So this is the sense in which I can just think about any stabilizer as actually specifying a code. So if I take any abelian subgroup of the n qubit poly group that doesn't contain the identity, minus the identity, so this is some condition that has to be satisfied. So if minus I is, let me say this subgroup is called S, so I have some subgroup of the n qubit poly group, and if it doesn't contain minus the identity, then it will specify a code. And what will the code space be? Well, the code space will be exactly, the set of states that are simultaneous plus one eigenvectors of all of the all of the operators, all of the stabilizer operators. Okay, so the code space will be T of S, which is the set of all states psi, such that M psi is equal to psi for all stabilizer operators M. So you can think about going either way. You can think about specifying a quantum error correcting code, and then if you look at the set of all of the operators that stabilize those code states, then that gives you what's called the stabilizer, and then it'll be some abelian subgroup of the polygroup. But you can also take basically any abelian subgroup of the polygroup, modulo this condition, and then that will define a quantum error correcting code, and here's what the code words will be. All right, so now what is the number of encoded qubits going to be if we have some general code of this form? Well, it turns out that the dimension of the code space for any such code will always be a power of 2. So it will always encode some integer number of qubits. So here k is going to be the number of encoded qubits, right? If the dimension of the space is 2 to the k, then that means we can encode k qubits into that space. And what is k going to be? Well, k is going to be equal to n minus the number of constraints that are imposed by the these conditions that you have to be a simultaneous plus one eigenvector of all of these operators. So if there are generators, then you have to subtract that off. So r should be the number of independent generators of the stabilizer. Right, so independent in the sense that here I could have also written down ZIZ as a stabilizer generator. But that would be redundant because I could get that as a product of this and this. So if you find the smallest set of stabilizer operators that actually generate the entire stabilizer and call that R, it won't depend, that number R won't depend on how you choose those operators, then the number of encoded qubits for some quantum error correcting code will be the number of physical qubits that you encode the data into minus the number of generators, minus the number of constraints that you imposed by specifying that you had to be a plus one eigenvector of these operators. Right? So maybe we can just quickly check that counting works for the examples that we've seen so far. So for the bit flip code, we have n equals 3, because we encode into 3 physical qubits, and we have 2 stabilizer operators, so we should have 1 encoded qubit. Right? And that's exactly what we had. We could encode 1 qubit into these 3 physical qubits. And same for the face flip code. And for the Shor code, now we have n equals 9. We have 9 physical qubits. And we have 8 stabilizer operators. So we have 6 for doing the syndromes for bit flip errors and 2 for the syndromes for face flip errors. So if we take 9 minus 8, we get again 1 encoded qubit. Right? So everything works out that this is a code that should be able to encode 1 qubit of information. Okay. So now, what can we say about how we would do error correction? Well, the way we would find the syndrome would be to measure the stabilizer operators, and those will identify what errors might have occurred. So in general, the eigenvalues of the stabilizer operators identify errors. So let's say we consider some error E. So we're always just worrying about errors that come from the poly group, because we know that if we can correct poly errors, then we can correct general errors. And suppose we have some stabilizer operator M, and then we have some code word psi. Psi should be an element of the code space, then what can we say? Well, it turns out that this error, so this is some poly operator, and this stabilizer operator is also some poly operator. So these two operators will either commute or anti-commute, right? Because if you take two things that are tensor products of poly operators, then, you know, for each coordinate, they either commute or anti-commute, because the you know, one qubit Pauli operators are either commuting or anti-commuting. And so overall, the whole thing will either commute or anti-commute. And on the basis of whether things commute or anti-commute, you can figure out, you know, you can figure out what these eigenvalues are, right? So if the error commutes with the stabilizer, right? So if the commutator of VNM is zero, then what can we say? Well, if we act with M on the state where the error has been applied, so we have, instead of psi, the error E was applied, so now we have the state E psi, and then we look at what happens if we apply M to that. Well, that's just the same as E times M psi. Psi, by definition, is a plus one eigenstate of M. That's what it means for M to be a stabilizer operator. So this is just the same thing as E psi, right? So what this says is that E psi is a plus one eigenvector of M. So if we look at the state where this error was applied, and then we measure the operator M, we'll get the eigenvalue plus one as our measurement outcome. Right? So this is a plus one eigenvector. And on the other hand, you know, we could have an error that anti-commutes with a particular stabilizer operator. And then what happens? So we want to look at what happens if we have M acting on E psi. And if they anti-commute, we're going to get a minus sign. So this is going to be minus E times M psi. And again, psi is a plus one eigenvector of M. So this is just going to be minus E psi. So this says that the state where the error has been applied is a minus one eigenvector of M. Right? And so now what we can do is we can, you know, make this measurement where we determine for each stabilizer operator, are we in the plus one eigenspace or are we in the minus one eigenspace? And this is going to tell us what error has been occurred. So in other words, we can imagine that the syndrome is just the set of eigenvalues of the stabilizer operators. And what we would like to do is measure all of the stabilizer operators to extract the syndrome. Fortunately, we can do that. We don't have to worry about the order in which we make these measurements. These operators are all things that we can simultaneously observe because the stabilizer is an abelian group, right? These stabilizer operators all commute with each other, and so they're observables that we can simultaneously measure. Okay. Okay, so now we want to understand something about, you know, once we have some code, what can we say about the errors that we can correct with that code, right? We would like to be able to understand what can a code actually achieve in terms of protection against noise. And the first thing to think about, I guess, is what are the errors that we can just detect? So in general, there's going to be a difference between whether you can detect whether an error has occurred and whether you can actually correct for that error. So let's first think about the errors that can be detected. And there's one other mathematical definition that we need here that's going to be useful, which is what's called the normalizer of the code. So these are going to be all of the things that, these are going to be the operators that commute with all of the stabilizer operators. Okay. So the normalizer of a code, and you can think about a code as just being specified by its stabilizer. So this normalizer will just be a property of the stabilizer S. This is going to be n of s, which is the set of n qubit Pauli operators that have the property that they commute with everything in the stabilizer. Okay, so that's the normalizer of s. And the normalizer elements are the ones that have trivial syndrome, right? So if you have something that's in the normalizer, then all of the, you know, those operators are going to be plus one, are going to give you plus one eigenvectors for all of the stabilizer elements, right? So anything in the normalizer, if you were to measure the syndrome, you would get the same result as if there were no error, right? So the things that are in the normalizer correspond to undetectable errors, well, if they were errors at all, right? So something that's actually just in the stabilizer itself is not really an error, right? Because that's something that's not changing the code words at all. That's just a plus one eigenvector, right? So the stabilizer acting on a code state just gives you the code state back. But something that's in the normalizer that doesn't have that property, something that actually changes the state, will correspond to some non-trivial and undetectable error, Right? So, so the set of undetectable errors is just the normalizer of the code. So in other words, the set N of S take away the stabilizer operators. So this thing with all of the stabilizer operators taken away, because if you apply a stabilizer operator, it's true that that's something that you can't distinguish from the identity being applied, but that's fine because it actually hasn't changed the code states at all. So this is the set of undetectable errors. Okay, so now the question is, what errors can we correct? These are the errors that we can't detect. So the errors that we can detect, or at least don't have to worry about detecting, are the things that are not in here. Okay, but it could be that there are some errors that we could detect, but we don't know how to correct them. There's not some correction, because there could be some ambiguity about what correction we should do. So to say what errors we can correct, there's something which is sometimes called the quantum error correction condition. Which is the following. So we say that a code with stabilizer S can correct errors, a set of errors, script E. So this is going to be just some subset of the n-qubit polygroup. The possible errors that we worry about correcting are all poly errors. And we'll say that such an error can be corrected. Such a set of errors can be corrected. So a code can correct for some set of errors, script E, if when you take any two errors from that set, we get something that corresponds to an undetectable error when we look at the product of the inverse of one of those errors and the other error. So maybe it's better if I just write this. So for all pairs E and F from the set script E, E dagger F is not an undetectable error. So this should not be an element of N of S take away S. Okay, so if you consider the action of the inverse of E times F, that corresponds to some other error that you might think about, and you want sort of the difference between the error that E applies and the error that F applies, in the sense of doing the inverse of one times the other, you want that to not be an undetectable error. Okay, I guess I was going to give an argument for why this was the case, but maybe in light of the time, I won't. This is certainly something that you can read about, for example, in Nielsen and Chuang. You want the action of E on the state psi and the action of F on the state psi. If you look at the difference of those two things, you don't want that to correspond to an undetectable error. It's okay if this gives you something. It's okay if E and F map the state psi to, so it's okay if there's like some overall error which is applied in both cases. It could be that E and F are the difference between E and F is something that you cannot detect. It's okay if that happens as long as the correction that you would have to apply in order to make things all right would be the same for both of them. So that's exactly what we saw here in the example of the Shor code, right? There were some errors, which you could think about as these errors E and F, where you couldn't detect the difference between those two errors, right? So we could apply a phase flip on the first qubit or a phase flip on the second qubit, and those had exactly the same effect. So the difference between those two errors is something that we could not determine. But that's all right, because we would have to apply the same correction for both of them. So that's this situation that we have with degenerate codes. When we have, distinct operators E and F that give us something that does something non-trivial, but where the correction we would have to do to get back to having the state be okay is the same thing. That's when we say that a code is degenerate. Okay. So what can we say about how many errors a code can correct? So there's this notion of the distance of a code, which has to do with how many errors the code can detect. So here another definition. The distance of a code S is the minimum weight of any undetectable error. So this is the minimum lost the microphone here. This is the minimum weight of E, where the weight is the number of non-identity polys in that operator, such that E is an undetectable error. So this is the number of non-identity polys. Okay, and now a fact that that is good to know about is that if you have a code that has distance 2t plus 1, then it can correct for any t single qubit errors, right? So a code with distance 2t plus 1 can correct any t qubit error. So for example, if you have a code that has distance 3, then it can correct any 1 qubit error. And the reason you need to have, you know, I mean, the distance is not describing exactly how many errors you can correct. It's just describing how many errors you can detect. And, you know, to be able to correct errors, you need to be able to detect sort of the difference between the errors. And that's where this factor of 2 is going to come from. So you have to be able to do better than that. So that's why the, you know, this condition we have here is that if we have distance 2t plus 1, then at least we can say that we can correct any t qubit error. Okay, so maybe I can just, I'm going to give you a little bit more notation, which is that, so we'll say S is a code with parameters n, k, and d if it encodes k qubits into n physical qubits and has distance d. So if it encodes k qubits into n and has distance d. And now what can we say about some of these codes that we've seen so far? So for example, the Shor code is a 9-qubit code with 1 encoded qubit, and its distance is 3. So, I mean, this is, you know, we haven't actually shown this, but it's at least consistent with this, the thing that we do know, which is that it can correct any single qubit error. So this is an example of what's called a 913 code. But now you could ask, could you get by with fewer physical qubits, right? So is it possible to have, you know, let's say we still want to, you know, encode only one logical qubit, and we want to be able to correct any single qubit error, so we want to have a code with distance 3. But you know, is this 9 as small as you could possibly make it? And it turns out that the answer is no. And you know, that we sort of saw a hint of that earlier when I mentioned that there are actually some 2-qubit errors that the code can correct. Right? So intuitively, if you were doing as well as possible, if you were getting by with the minimum number of qubits in order to correct any single qubit error, you wouldn't also have the ability to correct against multiple qubit errors. If things were designed in a really good way, maybe you would just be able to correct any single qubit error, but you wouldn't have any ability to correct errors on larger number of qubits. And it turns out that that's the case. So I want to mention some other codes that are known. And I'll describe them in terms of their stabilizers. I want to describe some other codes that that have better parameters. So two other codes that I want to mention are what's called the scene code, which was discovered actually at roughly the same time as the Shor code, which is a 713 code. So this is a code that still is going to be able to correct against any single qubit error, but it's only going to encode into seven physical qubits. So it's more efficient in the sense that it uses fewer physical qubits to still encode one logical qubit. And I can tell you what the what the stabilizer is for this code, and then you can kind of investigate its properties later if you're interested. So this is going to have the following stabilizer. So by the way, how many stabilizer operators am I going to write down? You should be able to tell me that before I. Yeah, 6, right? Because I've got 7 qubits, and I want to have only one encoded qubit. So if I specify 6 operators, then things will work out. Okay, so there should be 5 more. So we have x, x, I, x, x, I. And then one more x type operator. So x, i, x, i, x. Okay, so those are the three operators that have x's and i's in them. And then there are going to be three other operators that have i's and z's in them. And they're actually exactly the same operators, but where I replace x by z. So I'm going to have here z, 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 I, 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 and z, z, I, z, z, I, and z, I, z, I, z, I, z. Okay, so I just wrote down a quantum error correcting code, a stabilizer code. I mean, what I wrote down were the stabilizer operators, the generators of the stabilizer. But from this, you could work out what the code words are, right? So there should be a two-dimensional subspace of this 2 to the 7 dimensional Hilbert space where these operators act, which is the simultaneous plus 1 eigenspace of all of these operators, right? So each of these has a, 2 to the 6 dimensional plus 1 eigenspace. You take the intersection of all of those subspaces, and what you'll be left with is just a two-dimensional subspace, which is the code space. It's the space of the valid encodings of the states of a qubit with this code. So, I mean, I'm not going to write down explicitly what those code states are. You could think about how to work them out. But there is some two-dimensional space, and now we can get by with only 7 physical qubits. And it turns out that this code actually has a lot of nice properties in terms of how it can be used for fault tolerance, which I'll say a little bit more about later on. So this is actually a pretty important code from the standpoint of many practical things you might want to do with quantum error correction. Okay, but now I still haven't really answered the question of what's the best we can do for the number of qubits, right? So here we managed to get by with only 7 physical qubits, but could we get by with fewer? Okay, so it turns out you can get by with fewer. In fact, you can do even better than this. And there's another code, which is usually referred to as the 5-qubit code, because n equals 5 for this code. And it manages to do the same thing with only 5 logical qubits. So these Shor and Steen codes are examples of a kind of family of stabilizer codes that have even more nice structure, which are what are sometimes called CSS codes, which are codes where you can sort of think about the code as treating the x and the z errors separately. So you can think about them as combining two classical codes in a certain way to make a quantum code with some nice properties. But you don't have to do that in general. You can have codes that somehow are not treating the x and the z errors separately, but are just kind of handling everything in some quantum way. And that's something that the 5-qubit code does. And if you do this, then you can actually get by with better parameters, at least in the sense of how many physical qubits you need to encode one logical qubit. And so I'll tell you what the stabilizer is. So now how many operators do I need to write down? 4, right? So we should have 4 stabilizer operators, and they are the following. So x, z, z, x, I, and its cyclic permutations. So x, z, z, x, I, x, z, z, x, I, x, z, z, x, I. Right? So now I have my 4 operators. Okay, but you may be thinking there are 5 qubits, so there should be one more, right? So there should be one more where I have x, z, z, x, I. And it's true, actually, that operator is also in the stabilizer, but it's redundant, right? So you can find that operator as some product of the other operators. I think it's probably just the product of these 4 operators. So that is also a stabilizer operator. There is some symmetry in this code that enforces the fact that that's also a stabilizer operator. But I don't need to write it down to specify the code, because now I already have a generating set for the stabilizer. So now, again, you could work out what the states of 5 qubits are that encode a logical 0 and a logical 1. And, I guess I invite you to do that later. Okay. All right, and this is actually the best you can do. So it's not possible to encode one physical qubit into one logical qubit into 4 physical qubits and still be able to correct any single qubit error. Yes?
For larger systems, can you design codes by creating random, generating random strings? Do you actually need to design them?
I think in general you have to design them. So this isn't really my, you know, kind of area of expertise. You should ask, you know, Daniel maybe, and he could probably tell you more. But my guess would be that if you just pick, you know, so if you define a bunch of, just sort of choose your operators at random. Well, you have to choose them so that they're not already in the thing that you've taken so far. But you just, you know, in some random way, just generate stabilizer operators. I mean, my guess would be that what happens when you do that is that the code won't have good properties. Like, it won't be able to correct many errors. You know, it could be that it won't correct any errors, right? If you somehow you want to design things such that there's something special about errors being applied to only one qubit. So like somehow the quantum information is stored in some redundant way across many of the qubits, so that if local errors are applied, that's something that you'll be able to correct against. And somehow that's some structure that has to be built into the code.
But presumably you could search some, you know, space and then like just find the one that works best.
Right. So for example, you know, so this code was discovered by this CSS construction, I think, where there was this idea of combining two codes, and there was some sort of like insight that went into it. But I believe this code was actually discovered by computer search. Right? I mean, you can see that it's somehow, there's something very beautiful about it. There's just one operator, and it takes cyclic permutations of that, and that one operator has something, you know, it looks kind of nice. And I mean, you could imagine that some smart person, you know, wrote this down and said, oh, this surely will, you know, give me a nice quantum error correcting code. But I don't think that's how it was actually done. So Ray Laflamme was one of the people who was involved in discovering this code, and you could ask him about that. But I think that was the story, that it was actually found by some kind of numerical search. Other questions? Okay, so the last thing that I wanted to do was say a little bit about fault tolerance. So maybe I'll just do that now. I'll say at least a little bit about it, and perhaps we can finish up talking about it next time. And also next time we'll talk about quantum key distribution. I mean, I should also say that there's much more to be said about quantum error correcting codes than we had time to talk about. And there are many other codes. You could talk about codes where you encode more than one logical qubit into some number of physical qubits and talk about the error correcting properties of those codes. There's a lot of interesting stuff to investigate, but we only have so much time. Okay. So the question of fault tolerance is now, we have some idea for how we could encode quantum information so that we could store it in a good way, so that if some local noise was applied to the quantum state, then we would be able to recover the correct logical state, despite the fact that noise occurred. But now that's only good, that's only enough to do storage, right? So we have some quantum information and we want to keep it around. Okay, we can do that using error correcting codes, but now we can worry about, what if we want to do computation, right? So we have some quantum information that's let's say the qubits in Shor's algorithm or some other quantum algorithm that we want to run. And in general, when we run such an algorithm, there will be errors, right? We won't be able to do all of the operations perfectly. And we would like to be able to compute reliably despite the fact that our operations are noisy. In fact, I mean, even for the case of doing quantum error correction that we've talked about so far, something that was implicit in all of this discussion was that the encoding and the syndrome extraction and the correction operations that we did, we assumed that those were perfect, right? So we worried about, maybe some error being applied to the qubit. But then after the error was applied, we assumed that all of the stuff in that quantum circuit up there, I guess that the errors occur in between the encoding and the syndrome extraction and correction. But we assumed that all of the stuff that was in that circuit would be done perfectly, that there were no errors in the encoding and the decoding of the code. And of course, that's not a reasonable assumption if you have a realistic system. So if we were doing some computation, we would like to have some encoding where things would be okay, even though there might be errors in the operations that we're applying to the data, and even though there might even be errors when we're doing the encoding and when we're doing the decoding. Right, so anything that we're doing, there might be some error when we try to perform it. We might do it not quite perfectly, and we would like things to work out, even though we have the possibility of such errors. And of course, in order to have some kind of a result like that, we'll have to have some assumption about the nature of the errors, like the errors are not too big, and maybe some assumption about the form that they take, like some kind of independence between the errors acting on different qubits. Although you can even relax some of those sorts of assumptions. So we have to make some assumption about, let's say, the errors being weak in some sense. But it turns out that if you have such a thing, if the errors are in some sense not too strong, then you can then you can actually prove something about the ability to compute in the presence of noise. And this is area of fault tolerance. And actually, this question of fault tolerant computing, this issue came up even classically, and a long time ago, von Neumann was one of the pioneers of this area in the context of classical computing. So how you would do classical computing reliably, even in the presence of noise. Now, the classical computers that we use, your laptop or something like that, has a processor that's not actually using these ideas of fault-tolerant computing, at least not explicitly, because it turns out that we can build hardware that works very well in practice, and we just don't need to explicitly use this fault tolerance. But for quantum computers, we kind of expect that we really will need to use these fault-tolerant protocols. Okay, so that's what this is about, reliable computing in the presence of noise. And so the basic idea is going to be that we're going to take our quantum information, we're going to encode it using a quantum error correcting code, and then we want to somehow be able to operate on the data while it's still encrypted. Right? So we have our encrypted data, and then we're going to do some logical operations to it that will allow us to compute. So this is the idea. We'll encode in quantum error correcting codes and compute on the encrypted data. If we were to decode our entire code and then put our qubits into their logical states in an unencoded way, then they would be subject to noise that we wouldn't want to have to deal with. So it's really important that we be able to perform the computation on the data while it's still encrypted. Okay, so we can work out what the logical operations are that we would have to do in order to act on the encoding of the data and perform some logical operation on the code space. So for example, for the bit flip code, there's some logical X operator, which is just the operator XXX that flips all of the bits, right? That's some operator that would be hard for the environment to do. It's a non-local operator. But that's the operator that you would have to apply if you wanted to apply this X operation on the encoded subspace. And similarly, there's a logical Z operator, which now is not unique. There's not a unique choice of what the logical Z is, but it could be, for example, ZII. And the fact that this is a local operator corresponds to the fact that the bit flip code does not correct against phase flips. But what you can do is you can work out what the logical operations are that you should apply to the code states in order to perform some computation on them, and then those are the things that you would have to do in order for things to be fault tolerant. Okay, but now when you figure out how to do this, oh, we're out of sport. When you figure out how to do this, it's important that you think about a good implementation. So you want to design your code in such a way, you want to design your code and choose the way that you implement the logical operations in such a way that errors don't propagate badly when you try to do these encoded operations. So maybe I'll just give one example of that and then we'll continue next time. Okay, so when choosing how to do logical operations on our code words, we should design the implementation so that errors don't propagate badly. So this is especially a problem when you want to do multi-qubit gates. So here's a very simple example of this. This is kind of the canonical example of how you might worry about error propagation. So suppose we want to do a CNOT on the bit flip code. right? So we have two logical qubits that have both been encoded in the bit flip code. So that means that we have six physical qubits. So this is the first logical qubit. This is the second logical qubit. And now suppose we want to do a CNOT from the first logical qubit to the second logical qubit, right? So one way that we could do that would be the following. I guess I need a little bit more space. One way we could do that would be the following. So this qubit is either in the state, well, it could be in some superposition, but the basis states are 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1, corresponding to logical 0 and logical 1. So if we just control on the first qubit, then that will tell us what we should do on all of these three qubits. All right, so we could do like this. All right. So this is a way of representing the logical CNOT gate on the encoded data. Okay, but this is a really bad way to do it. This is not what you want to do, because suppose there's some single qubit error that occurs up here. Right? If we have a single qubit error over here, then after we do this implementation of a CNOT gate, then, well, there's going to be that error still on this qubit. But now that's going to cause an error on all three of these qubits down here. Right? So up here, we have only a one qubit error on this block. So that's fine. That's something we can correct. But here, we have a three qubit error. And that's something that the bit flip code cannot correct for. So this, this is bad. Right? We have these three single qubit errors, and we can't correct for them. But there's a better way, it turns out, to deal with this, to implement this CNOT gate, which is to do it what's called what's sometimes called transversally, which just means that we do the CNOT between the first qubit of the first block and the first qubit of the second block, and similarly for the second and third qubits. So if we do this, this transversal CNOT, this will also perform a CNOT on the code space. You know, there are many ways to do the logical CNOT because the information has been encoded redundantly. So we have a choice for how we should do the logical CNOT. And if we do it in this way, then things are not nearly so bad, right? So here, if we have an error over here, then at the end of the day, there's going to be an error on the first qubit and an error on the fourth qubit. But that's still something we can correct because we have a code that can correct for single qubit errors, right? So so now we can still deal with this. And it turns out that, you know, for any single qubit error that might be applied anywhere here or anywhere here, we'll still only have a single qubit, we'll still only have single qubit errors on the individual blocks over here, and we'll be able to correct. So these are the kinds of issues you have to worry about when you think about an implementation of the gates on the code words, and you want to make you want to be able to show something about fault tolerance. So next time we'll talk just a little bit more about, you know, kind of the basic ideas of fault tolerance and how you can arbitrarily reduce the error rate to get something that's called the fault tolerant threshold theorem, and then the last thing we'll talk about will be quantum key distribution. Any last questions? Okay, so see you.
See you not tomorrow, but on Friday. So tomorrow we'll.